Hello, and welcome to the Endocrine Outlook Podcast. I'm Patrick Campbell, Senior Editor of the Endocrinology Network, and I'll be your host for this episode of the Endocrine Outlook Podcast. In this episode, you'll get to check out an interview I had with Dr. Georgiana Dobry, a board-certified neuroendocrinologist with Weill Cornell Medicine. In the interview, Dr. Dobry and I discuss Cushing's disease and the role osilodrostat can play in the treatment of the rare disease. Approved earlier this year, osilodrostat has the potential to improve the lives of patients for whom pituitary surgery is not an option or has not been curative. For more on Cushing's disease and the role osilodrostat and its approval can have on the lives of patients, here is my interview with Dr. Dobry.
My name is Georgiana Dobry. I'm an endocrinologist. I trained in Cleveland Clinic where I had a more in-depth exposure to adrenal and pituitary diseases. That was my interest ever since I was in medical school. If somebody would ask me, what do you want to do in life? What do you want to be? I would say, oh, I want to do pituitary and adrenal disease. So I knew that from the beginning. It might sound a little too much, but no, actually as a student, I was drawn towards this part of these pathologies and the hormones and everything. I trained in Cleveland Clinic. I stayed on staff there, and I had the pituitary and adrenal clinic in Cleveland Clinic. I moved to Cornell about 4 years ago, and I came here to kind of help build a pituitary clinic, a pituitary center of excellence. There are some amazing neurosurgeons here with a lot of experience in pituitary surgery. And as much as we like to admit it or not, as endocrinologists, for a lot of these diseases, they're the centerpiece. They're the most first important step for things to go well, a really an experienced neurosurgeon. I'm the medical director of the pituitary center, neuroendocrine diseases here at Weill Cornell. We function as a multidisciplinary team. We have pituitary board every 2 weeks. The patient is seen by me, by the neurosurgeon, in the same office, in the same environment. They don't need to travel, so we're trying to incorporate that and make it easier for the patient and to deliver the best and the fastest care that way.
All right, thank you for that. And that was actually a really interesting story. It's cool to see that your life path has allowed you to do what you really wanted to do.
Yeah, I consider myself lucky because to start with is I'm taking care of a patient population. You know, it's not like diabetes. It's going to be everywhere. So I was lucky that it worked out for me, I guess.
Well, talking about these patients, for those of you listening, the purpose of our interview today is to discuss LINK-3 and osilodrostat as a whole. So let me ask you, Dr. Dobry, just point blank, what were some of the biggest highlights from LINK-3? And what does it tell clinicians about the use of osilodrostat in a real-world setting?
Okay. I guess to start with real-world versus clinical trial, it's going to be a little bit different. The way I look at clinical trials is that they're trying to prove that they're somewhat efficacious, that they're safe. How well to use it and what to make of it is going to take a couple of years and some use in the clinical practice. It is a somewhat complicated study, let's put it this way. It is a multi-center clinical trial that was randomized. It had a period of withdrawal, 8 weeks of withdrawal that was randomized placebo versus active drug. What was interesting is that we had about 202 patients that were enrolled. That were screened, about 137 of them were enrolled, and 4 study periods followed. In the first 12 weeks, the patient's dose was titrated. And what is interesting, and it's not really real life, as you said, or clinical practice, is the way that was done. And that I think kind of translates into some of the results as well. Like, for example, every 2 weeks, the patient's oscillodrostat dose was able to be increased if the urine free cortisol was still above the normal range, 24-hour urine free cortisol, which in real life, let's be serious, by the time you start, by the time you send the patient asleep for a lab, most of the times it takes close to 2 weeks to get back a result. By the time you communicate to the patient or you see the patient, if you're lucky, you'd be able to do that maybe 4 to 6 weeks from starting the dose. So this is a little bit more artificial, I would say. In a way, it's good because they increase the dose quickly. You cannot wait for 6 months to increase the dose and to assess. It would be not very feasible and very expensive. But on the other hand, it's not real life. And there were a number of withdrawals due to side effects. And the main side effect was the adrenal insufficiency or the adrenal withdrawal, which I know from my patients who are after a surgery on a higher dose of hydrocortisone that I want to decrease, or if I'm starting them on a medication that's supposed to control the cortisol levels, either block them or decrease them, I know they're going to be miserable in the first 2 weeks. And after that, it takes them some time, get used to that. Maybe they feel a little better. Maybe they're going to increase or decrease again, depending on the situation. So this is quite accelerated. And I think they're bound to have a little more side effects on the adrenal insufficiency side or adrenal withdrawal side. And those patients were counted kind of towards as failing the trial. They were put there towards the total. So for 12 weeks, every 2 weeks, the dose could have been increased up till 12 weeks. From there, they would go on two different paths. If they're by 12 weeks, their 24-hour urine free cortisol was normal, which again, it's very ambitious for real life for that to happen for clinical practice. They would go on a route that, okay, let's try to maintain this dose. And if the dose is maintained and the cortisol control is maintained by 24 weeks, you can go on the randomization phase. If you're not controlled by 12 weeks, yes, you can continue the open label trial. Or if any time in between 12 to 24 weeks, you have, you increase your urine free cortisol, you lose the control, you're allowed to increase the dose, but you're not allowed to go into the randomization phase. So this is, there are a number of patients who are controlled at 12 weeks, and it's really hard to know exactly for sure what was the number that lost control by the 24 weeks. This is something that is not really well noted in the trial, I would say. With some of these steroidogenesis inhibitors, what happens as you lower the free cortisol, especially the 11 beta hydroxylase inhibitor, as you lower the cortisol level, you lose some of that feedback on the ACTH producing tumor. The tumors don't listen to the feedback as well as the normal corticotroph cells, but there is some feedback there that they listen to. So then the ACTH increases, and sometimes you lose control of the cortisol via this mechanism. So it's possible that some of these patients were controlled at 12 weeks. Maybe they were not controlled at 24 weeks because they were already escaping. Or, you know, the tumors have variable secretion of ACTH. So maybe there was a point in time at 12 weeks when they were secreting less and then seemed like an appropriate dose, but then by 24 weeks there were some fluctuations and then the levels were not maintained. I like a little more how they're saying that, you know what, yes, by 24 weeks 52% of the patients were enrolled, so a little bit over half were able to have normal urine-free cortisol at 24 weeks without increasing the dose from 12 to 24. But maybe this is a little harder to achieve in real life. And I like that about 66-67% of them achieved control by 24 weeks if they were allowed to have other dose increments in a more close to real life kind of time frame. So by 24 weeks, we have another good percentage of patients who got control. Also, it's interesting, and I think we're going to know from the extension phase, which I understand that was finished, but we don't have the data yet, how many more of these patients lost control or maintained control because of this mechanism that is kind of known and is not that much mentioned in the study as a potential issue that we need to consider when we use this kind of medication. What was the primary endpoint was to compare the patients who were on active drug during the 8 weeks of withdrawal of randomization compared to the ones who were on placebo. And about 86% of them maintained the normal urine free cortisol during those 8 weeks, and only about 30% of the placebo patients taking placebo or maintain the urine free cortisol. To know is that although they maintained it, I think with one patient exception, all of them were on an uptrend. They were increasing the urine free cortisol. So I wonder if maybe they were 3 months on placebo or a little more than that, probably a lot more would have the urine free cortisol outside of the normal range. As secondary endpoints, where they had cardiovascular related parameters, sugar, hemoglobin A1C, lipids, weight, BMI, waist circumference, quality of life, which is an important thing that we're starting to look more and more in the last years, depression inventory, all of these improved during the study. There was a slight decrease in HDL, but overall, all these cardiovascular related parameters improved. Some other areas that I understand that they're going to publish when it comes to changing bone mass on some of the physical signs associated with Cushing's syndrome. So I'm curious to see what the data is going to be on that.
All right, thank you for that. Now, when we look at, you touched on it a bit and you answered my next question, which was going to be related to the sort of the effect it had on other comorbidities and conditions like the cardiovascular risk factors. Now, when we look at data like this, I know that the Link 4 study was published not too long after Link 3. What else do clinicians need to know before they can feel comfortable prescribing this to their patients in real world settings, or should that comfort level be there based on the clinical data already?
I guess it's the efficacy, which is there. I mean, if you look at this trial and thinking, okay, I'm looking for a drug that's going to be a miraculous drug for all my Cushing's patients and to be used as monotherapy, you might be a little disappointed by looking like, I don't know, this primary, secondary point, only half of the patients maintain their normal 24-hour urine-free cortisol at 6 months without changing in the dose. I mean, really, it's just like you flip a coin. Again, if we look at the other medications on the market, I would say that a lot of them have even a lower control rate than this one. All of them have their own side effects. For this particular medication, for example, what transpires from the trial and what we kind of expected side effects would be that, you know, you block the 11 beta hydroxylase and you're gonna have an increase in 11 deoxycortisol, which is for the most part, as far as we know, inactive, but also an increase in 11-deoxycorticosterone, which acts as a mineralocorticoid. And this is a patient that can potentially have worsening of high blood pressure. It could be a patient that has developed hypokalemia and could be a woman that can have increase of hirsutism because some of these precursors can go on the testosterone production. So these are questions that we kind of asked, knowing how metiropon was used off-label before oscilandrostat was approved. And I mean, I was in a way, well, it was a nice surprise to see that only 10% of the women mentioned that acne and hirsutism were issues, and it doesn't seem that it was a cause to stop the medications. So overall, they were pleased with the effects of controlling the cortisol comparing to the acne and the hirsutism. And also what's important to know is about, I think 13% developed hypokalemia. Not everybody will develop it, but there are going to be patients, especially in the ones where you use high doses, that might go to 2 point something as a dose. I think it went as low as 2.6 or something of that nature, the potassium. So that can be dangerous, can be fatal, can give arrhythmia. So you need to be aware of that. About 4% of the patients had some QT prolongation and some changes needed to be made. About 50%, I believe, of the patients were added some antihypertensive medications as a result of being in the study. About 70% were on anti-hypohypertension medication, but about 50% of them had changes and these were added during the study. So there are things to be aware in the clinical practice, just not to go just by the urine-free cortisol and keep on increasing. And always bear in mind that some of these patients, I was happy to see that not too many, will have worsening of high blood pressure and hypokalemia that can be dangerous. So, but again, these are not surprises. Sometimes in a clinical trial, you might see things that, wow, I didn't expect for this good effect or bad effect to happen, or for to be so, the impact to be so dramatic. Here, there were no surprises, I would say, and the rate maybe was a little bit lower than expected, hard to say, but that's important to take in clinical practice. Another thing that I would like to mention is it's kind of put out there in like a couple of lines for the clinical endocrinologist who's going to use this medication. The way the medication works is going to increase the 11-deoxycortisol. For most of the assays, this is going to interfere with and artificially increase the actual cortisol level. So you might be looking at your urine-free cortisol, it's like, oh, it's still high, and you keep on increasing the dose, and the patient might be adrenal insufficient. So you need to measure the 24-hour urine cortisol or the serum cortisol via mass spectroscopy, but via LC-MS, because otherwise you might measure the 11-deoxycortisol and the cortisol together and will be reported on the cortisol. So you might get full that way and the patient will already be, and again, to measure it this way, it's a send out, it takes even much longer to come back. So that's another thing to bear in mind, that in clinical practice every 2 weeks, it's not gonna happen. Right. So I guess, I don't know how much I answered some of the safety, but I guess they touch based on whatever we were expecting to find, and there weren't any surprises either on the negative or really positive side. So I would be comfortable prescribing it, just knowing what to expect.
All right, thank you for that. And now just lastly, sort of staying on that same point, what portion of patients with Cushing disease do you think oscilandrostat is appropriate for? Is it for most of them? I know we've looked at different patient populations in different trials. So at this point, after all the patient populations it's been studied in, about what portion of Cushing's patients do you think this is appropriate for?
I guess if we think that Cushing's disease is about 85 to 90% of the patients with Cushing's syndrome, most of the studies, and this study was for patients with Cushing's disease to start with. I think it would work pretty well in somebody with mild, moderate hypercortisolemia, and it might be used as a single drug, and it might control normalize the urine-free cortisol. Maybe if the patient is lucky, you're lucky, they're not going to be any side effects. You slowly up titrate it. It's going to be well tolerated, not much of hypokalemia, hypertension. I might be inclined to use it a little bit more in men than women, just because of the 10% of the hirsutism and acne side effect. And some women, you're going to be surprised, but it's like, even if there's, I don't know, even less than that risk of acne and hirsutism, some women are going to be, no, can you recommend something else? And some are going to be, oh, I just want to feel better. We'll talk about this some other time. So maybe men, maybe I would start it as a monotherapy. Now, to bear in mind, this would be also a great drug for a combination therapy, either combined with cabergoline, which is non-FDA, or ketoconazole, one of the newer agents that are on the pipeline, like levoketoconazole. You don't really need to be focused that, no, I'm going to use this medication and I'm going to increase it to maximum possible, whatever was recommended there, and get focused that I need to get control. Sometimes it might be a better idea to go to a certain dose with this medication, especially when you're starting to experience more hypokalemia or hypertension, added to something else, to get less side effects from both medications and make an individualized treatment for the patient, so you get better outcomes. So that's how I would look at it.
All right, thank you. And now, that was really a bit or about it on my questions related to osilodrostat. Was there anything else you wanted to add that you think it's important for clinicians to keep in mind when looking at Link 3 or any of the other data?
I guess, as I said, to have an open mind and think that this is a disease that, to start with, it's matched with controls. The mortality is 2 times more than matched controls. And if you failed the first surgery and your levels are uncontrolled, it's 4 times higher. So don't look at this as like, oh, it's only 50% that there was this side effect and there was this side effect. Just to choose it in the appropriate setting, in the appropriate patient, I think it's a great tool. We had before the non-FDA use of metirapone to control well the levels, which is also a 11 beta hydroxylase inhibitor, the same way as osilodrostat works, needed to be used 3 times a day, even 4 times a day. So the convenience factor is there already, that it can be used twice a day to achieve the control. To always look for the potassium and the high blood pressure, and not to be scared to combine it with another drug. It's a great tool to have in the inventory.
All right, thank you for that, and thank you for all the perspective that you shared today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you again to Dr. Dobry for taking part in this interview. That's it for this episode of the Endocrine Outlook. I'm Patrick Campbell, Senior Editor with Endocrinology Network. Thank you for listening.